Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in real life. This is podcast number 44. I'm recording it on Thursday, November 13th, 2008. The PE 10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition when purchased at today's prices. The title of this podcast is Investing News Makes Us Dumb. That title comes from the title of a book that I read a long time ago. It was probably 20 years ago or so. There was a book I read entitled The News Makes Us Dumb. And that title drew my attention for two reasons. One, I've made my living as a journalist for a long, long time. And so the idea that generating and reading news is a bad thing instead of a good thing naturally seemed provocative to me. And also, I had a friend. I used to read. I've cut back myself on newspapers today. I don't actually read any newspaper today regularly. I sometimes read things on the internet, but I don't read any newspaper as a daily proposition. But once upon a time, I used to work covering Capitol Hill. I used to cover tax legislation on Capitol Hill. And I used to read four newspapers every day. It amazes me today. I used to read every morning. I would read the Washington Post, the Washington Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. And I had a friend who said that he had given up reading newspapers. And the time that he used to spend reading newspapers, an hour a day or whatever it was, he switched over and would read books. And he said that after 6 months, he felt that he had learned much more about the world spending an hour a day reading books instead of reading newspapers. So when I saw this book entitled The News Makes Us Dumb, I checked it out. And I don't recall hardly anything about the book today. I believe the general premise was along the lines of what my friend was saying, that the newspapers tend to focus on, obviously they focus on developments rather than giving the history and giving the full background of a subject matter. And the result is that we tend to news deals in trivialities, and so you can spend a great deal of time reading news and you're up to date on all these trivialities, but you never come to possess a deep understanding of the issue that you're following. Whereas if you were to read a book that would go in depth on the subject, you would actually have a deeper understanding, even though you didn't read each day's current developments. If you got into a conversation, you would quickly be able to come up to speed on the current development if you had the rich background. But if you have the trivialities without the rich background, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have holes in your understanding. That's the general concept. And I was, as what usually happens is that I was reading some comments on a discussion board this morning. That's what usually gets my blood going and causes me to plug in a mic and start laying down a podcast. And I thought about that. That title came to my mind. News, the news makes us dumb, and I thought investing news makes us dumb. And I think that's right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that theme. First, I'm always picking on poor John Bogle in these podcasts. John Bogle is, I don't know if he's my hero or my nemesis. I am a big fan of John Bogle, but I think he went seriously off track with his endorsement of the passive investing model. And so what I think John Bogle did was he changed our understanding of how stock investing works in a profound way. I view John Bogle as the main force behind the indexing revolution, which I think has changed the way middle-class Americans invest in a very important and very positive way. While I think passive investing is the enemy of the middle-class investor, and Bogle is unfortunately the lead proponent both of the investing strategies I most like and the investing strategy that I most dislike. And so Bogle is very much a mixed bag in my eyes. And what I try to do is take the Bogle revolution and channel it in a different direction, a non-passive direction. The distinction is that passive investing, which Bogle endorses, says that you do not need to change your stock allocation in response to price changes. So even when stocks are priced at insanely dangerous levels, as they were from 1995 through the first half of 2008, there's no need to change your stock allocation. You can just stay at that same old stock allocation that made sense at a time when stocks were priced at reasonable levels. Rational investing, which is the model that I advocate at my website and on these podcasts, says just the opposite. Rational investing says that you must change your stock allocation when prices change dramatically, that the goal should be not to stick with the same stock allocation, but to stick with roughly the same risk level. So since stocks are far more risky when they are priced high, you should lower your stock allocation at such times to keep your risk level roughly constant. One thing, though, that Bogle says that I very much agree with is Bogle says to ignore the daily ups and downs in the stock market. The distinction I just drew between passive investing and rational, passive investing, which I criticize, and rational investing, which I advocate, it seems to be very simple, doesn't it? It seems to be just a very, you know, it's one little difference. I'm saying the rational investor changes his stock allocation in response to price changes, while the passive investor does not. That's the thing he's passive about. He always sticks to the same stock allocation. That's one little difference. Is that really a total change in the model of how stock investing works? The answer is that it is. That question of how you set your stock allocation is so fundamental that it affects every decision you make in the investing arena. It's counterintuitive, but it's true. And the longer I spend looking at these questions, the more I learn that this is true. All of my investigation of investing issues started with my examination of the safe withdrawal rate question. And I learned that the safe withdrawal rate is not a constant number, but it's a number that changes with changes in stock allocations. And from that discovery, I started looking at other investing questions. When I saw the reaction, that was really the reaction that caused me to go down this path. The reaction of many passive investors was that they didn't dare think about how the safe withdrawal rate changed. I want to be fair. The majority of community members at the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities wanted to explore the realities of safe withdrawal rates. But there was a group of passive investing dogmatists that cannot bear the thought of examining these questions. And that got my spidey sense tingling, and I started trying to figure out why that was, why it was such a controversial issue, why it was such a hot button issue for a good number of investors. And what I've learned is that how we set our stock allocation is just fundamental. I think what it is that it's the one thing that the investor has control over. We don't have control over anything else. You can say, interest rates cause changes in stock prices, or inflation is important, or, you know, whatever you want to say. But the one thing that really affects us is our stock allocation. That determines your level of success. And so if you are following a model that gets the decisions about the stock allocation wrong, and that's what passive investing does, by failing to take into consideration valuations in the determination of the stock allocation, passive investing gets the stock allocation question wrong. If you get that wrong, you end up getting everything wrong. You're building on a weak foundation. And so rational investing aims to get that allocation question right. But what happens is rational investing gets all sorts of things right just because it gets the allocation right. Because what happens is you adopt a different way of thinking about stock investing. I don't say this to brag, but I say it to be descriptive of what I think is reality. You adopt a sane approach to choosing your stock allocation, a sensible, realistic, feasible, effective, practical approach to choosing your stock allocation. And when you do that, it's a change from night to day. Instead of feeling more and more anxious about your stock investing choices as time goes on, you feel more and more confident. And what's really happening as I record these podcasts is that I'm learning almost each day. I don't know, I record about 3 a week, I imagine. Each time I record one, I myself am learning about some new element of the story, some new way in which making the shift from passive to rational causes a light switch to flip in the investor's brain. And it just causes you to see all of these different topics in a different light. So I want you to know, I don't have a list of these podcasts. I don't have a master list. And then I go in and record them. I didn't start out saying, someday I'm going to have to record a podcast about investing, how investing news makes us dumb. I just, every day I sort of spend a few minutes in the morning going over, blogs or discussion boards or whatever, articles on the internet, and I see something and it triggers something in my mind because I look at the world through the eyes of a rational investor. I look at the world through the eyes of an advocate of the rational investing model. And I see somebody say something and I just say, whoa, wait a minute. You know, a great example of that was in the last podcast, number 43. I talked about how the Wall Street Journal had an article earlier this week, I think it was Monday, in which this fellow was talking about, should you put your money into stocks now? You know, we've been going through all this turmoil. And he just had a line. It was just a sentence in there. And the sentence said, there is no random walk. And that just made bells ring in my head. Now, I think that's true. I don't think there is a random walk in the short term. But it just set me off. It set me thinking, why is it that this fellow can say in the Wall Street Journal that there is no random walk, and yet if you turn to Money Magazine or your local newspaper and you see one of these question and answer columns where people are trying to, you know, ask questions about how to invest, all of the responses, not all the time, but 90% of the time, are influenced by the passive investing school. Why is that? When actually there are very smart people out there writing for the Wall Street Journal who don't support the passive investing school. This fellow obviously didn't support passive investing if he says there's no random walk. So I just marvel at things like that. And I'm sure that I was reading these articles in earlier days, but I didn't notice things like that. But once you reject the passive model and adopt the rational model, You start noticing all these things that before you just sort of skimmed over. Passive investing is not just an investing strategy. It is a mindset. When you become a passive investor, what you really are doing, and I know that people think this sounds harsh, but I have to say it the way I see it. When you become a passive investor, what you're doing is you're turning off your human reason. You're giving into an emotion. There is no rational argument for ignoring prices when setting your stock allocation. It's purely an emotional act. And when you go down that emotional path, you adopt an entire language. There's a language of passive investing. And I'm learning this more and more all the time. I'm learning it as I tell you about it. And there's just a way of looking at the world, which is the passive investing way of looking at the world. And it's a highly emotional way of looking at the world. And all that rational investing really is an attempt to tune out that emotional junk. It's negative emotions we're talking about. When I say passive investing is emotional, it's negative emotions that drive it. And rational investing is an attempt. I don't think it's a completely successful attempt. I think the negative investing emotions affect us all, even rational investors. But rational investors are more aware of the threat and make a sustained effort to overcome those negative emotions. So all the time we're discovering things like how investing news makes us dumb. So I started by saying that one of Bogle's greatest contributions, if not his greatest contribution, I think this may be Bogle's greatest contribution, is that he argues that we should ignore the news. He agrees that news makes us dumb. Bogle, he laughs at people that follow the day-to-day developments in the market. He refers to it as noise. He says, that's just noise. Tune it out. Focus on the long term. Don't worry about, you know, stocks went up 50 points today. They went down 50 points the other day. Tune it all out. And something very interesting is that Robert Shiller does the same. Not many people think of Robert Shiller and John Bogle as thinking alike. There's a lot of hostility to Shiller. If you go on discussion boards where there are a lot of passive investing enthusiasts, you will see hostility to Robert Shiller, the author of Irrational Exuberance. But Shiller, he has at least a chapter. I know he has a full chapter in his book on the media and the role that the media plays in misinforming people about how investing works. Not informing their readers how stock investing works, misinforming them. And what Shiller attributes it to is really just that the media loves topics where there are daily developments. You know, they love having a weather section because people turn to the weather section every day. They love having a comics section because people turn to the comics every day, not just once. They love having a horoscope section. They love having a sports section because even if you read yesterday's paper and you know what the scores were yesterday, you have to buy another paper today to find out the scores today. And so when it comes time to putting together the financial page, they love focusing on the daily ups and downs. They love focusing on the trivial. They love focusing on the Dow went up so much, the Dow went down so much. Bogle has preached against following that trivial stuff he's done that for 30 years. And he's right. And I think Bogle makes the point. It's not just that it's trivial. It's not just that it's pointless. It's not just that it's a waste of time. It's worse than that. When you follow the daily developments, you're not just wasting your time. You're buying into a mindset. You're getting interested in something that will actually, it not only will not help you, it actually hurts you. Because it makes you emotional. It makes you get scared. When prices are going down, you get scared and you want to pull out. You want to change your strategy before it's had a chance to work. And when stocks are going up, you get emotional in the other direction. And that's not what you want to do. And so all of that, that's what I love about John Bogle's advice. He's right on about all that. Where I think Bogle fails is that he doesn't look, and Bogle is active. He was active in the Vanguard Diehards discussion board community. He now participates at the Bogleheads.org community. He doesn't post. He's posted on rare occasions. But he doesn't post regularly. But he appears at the annual meeting. And he said in a magazine article once that he checks out the board once on a weekly basis. So I consider Bogle a participant in those communities. But I think what I wish Bogle would do is spend more time thinking about what he sees when he checks in on those communities. Because Bogle's advice is to ignore the short-term noise. Go take a trip to bogleheads.org. Look at the threads. Ask yourself, are these people ignoring the day-to-day ups and downs? They sure don't seem to be ignoring the day-to-day ups and downs when I look. They're talking about this crash in stock prices all the time. All the time. They're focused on it. They're obsessed with it. I don't think that's too strong a word. Now, I follow many of Bogle's ideas. I consider myself a Boglehead. I certainly do not consider myself a passive investor. By no means. I don't follow this stuff. I don't follow this stuff. The only extent to which I follow it is I read discussions of other people talking about it just to learn how their minds are working, to learn how they think about investing, because that helps me flesh out the rational investing model, and it helps me come up with effective criticisms of the passive investing model. My work is to help people transition from the failed passive investing model to what I believe is the investing model of the future, rational investing. So I read these threads for the purpose of advancing that work, but I have zero interest on any kind of personal level in knowing, did the Dow go up 50 points today, or did the Dow go down 50 points, or recently it's been more like 200 points up or down. I genuinely could care less. It doesn't matter to me. And that's where I think Bogle dropped the ball. He has an idea that's right and powerful and important, that we need to tune out the news. Investing news makes us dumb, says Bogle and says Rob Bennett. We're in agreement on that. But Bogle's approach to investing, which in fairness, he is influenced by the passive investing model. Bogle is an advocate of passive investing. There's no question about it. He's the lead advocate. When you advocate passive investing, your advice to ignore the daily ups and downs, the noise of the market, is ignored by most of your followers. It doesn't work. And the reason is because passive investing, it purports to be a long-term model, but in truth, it is really not. And I was thinking over, as I was putting together some notes for this podcast, I was thinking over why that is. And I thought about some comments that Burton Malkiel made that I discussed in an article I have at the website. And I don't recall the title of the article. It's in the Stock Drunk section, I'm fairly confident, and there are about three or four articles there dealing with the efficient market theory, and it was one of those. And in one of those theories, in one of those articles, I talked about if I think about it a little bit, the title will come to me, but if you check out that section of the site, I think you'll find it. Excuse me. And I talked about Burton Malkiel, he's the author of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and a big-time passive investing advocate. And Burton Malkiel talked about what he thinks is going on when there are changes in stock prices on a day-to-day basis. And Malkiel, of course, believes in the efficient market theory. That's the intellectual framework for the passive investing model. And the efficient market theory, what Malkiel says is happening is that every day there are, of course, news developments. There are things going on that in theory affect stock prices. There are economic developments. Let's say, you know, interest rates are dropping, or the economy's heading into a recession, or there's a terrorist attack, or whatever happens to be going on. And what, under Malkiel's theory, what is happening is all investors are reacting to this news, and on a composite basis, the market is reacting properly. No one investor knows what the proper reaction is, but on the whole, the market is efficient, says Malkiel, and therefore the reaction is the proper one. And if you try to outsmart the market by thinking you know the proper reaction, you will get it wrong, most likely. That's the efficient market theory. That's the passive investing theory. That's Malkiel's theory. What Rob Bennett says, what the rational investing model says, is that yes, the market is efficient in the distant long run. In 30 years, the market is efficient. The market will eventually get things right, but it takes a long time. And in the short term, according to the rational theory, the market is highly inefficient. And in the medium long term, say 10 years out, it's a mix. The market is partly efficient and partly inefficient. And that's why prices become predictable only when you go at least 5 years out. And to become statistically significant, the predictions really have to be 10 years out. Because at 10 years out, the market is sufficiently efficient that prices become predictable. The stock market becomes predictable. But at 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, the market is almost entirely emotional. And emotions are not predictable. They're, by definition, irrational. So the reason why we, you know, one of the questions people ask me all the time, they say, Rob, you tell us that the stock market prices can be predicted 10 years out, but yet you say you cannot predict them 1 year out. Well, how can that be? If you can't predict them 1 year out, how the heck can you predict them 10 years out? The answer is that 10 years out, stock prices are determined by something rational. They're determined by economic realities. And economic realities are not entirely predictable, but they are to a large extent predictable. They are at least rational. So you can at least take a stab at predicting them and have a good bit of success. Not perfect success, but you can get a good neighborhood number. But 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, no. Stock prices are set by emotion in the short term, and emotions are entirely unpredictable. Now, that's the difference between the two models. And, you know, an objection I think that some might have to that is, I know John D. Craig, my old friend at the Vanguard Diehards board, would have this objection. That I'm saying prices are emotional, set by emotion, and unpredictable in the short term. That they're not. I'm saying that stock prices are not really responsive to economic developments, which is Malkiel is saying they are, and I'm saying they're not. Now, what gets a little tricky is that there is no question but that there is some correlation between economic developments and changes in stock prices. So, for example, when we had the 9/11 terrorist attack, stock prices, you know, crashed. Clearly, there was a connection between the event in the outside world and the stock market price. And that's what causes people to believe that these news developments are important. They see that, you know, we see that, okay, there's a terrorist attack. The market price changes dramatically. Therefore, our minds think there's a connection between outside events, terrorist attacks or recessions or the Fed changing the interest rate level. And the stock market price, it seems as though these things are connected in some way. And so we start reading the newspaper in an attempt to figure out what that connection is. But the reality is there is no connection that can be figured out. There is a connection, but there's a connection going on, but it's not the sort of connection we're expecting to see. What's going on, I believe, is that emotions affect stock prices. Stock prices are determined by investor emotions in the short term. And the 9-1-1 attack is causing investors to become emotional. And then their emotions cause changes in the market price. So there's sort of an indirect effect or a two-stage effect. But that's very different from what Melchale is saying, because what Melchale is saying is when there's a terrorist attack, people are processing what happened, you know, how big the destruction was, how much risk it represents to U.S. businesses, all this sort of thing. What's the chance it's going to bring on a recession? All these things are being processed through our brains and our computers, and we're coming to conclusions almost instantly. You know, within the market is supposed to be efficient almost instantly. And we're adjusting prices to reflect the new realities. And I'm saying something very different. I'm saying, yes, the terrorist attack causes emotion. And yes, emotion causes a change in the stock price. But there's no rationality going on. All that's happening is there's a terrorist attack and we get frightened. And our emotions go kerplooey. And then stock prices go kerplooey. But there's no rhyme or reason to it. We're not necessarily processing things properly. So, for example, if you could study this, unfortunately, there's no way to study it that I know of. You know, if you studied it scientifically, you might find that in some cases a terrorist attack would cause stock prices to go down, as happened after 9-1-1. And in other cases, a terrorist attack would cause stock prices to stay the same. And in other cases, a terrorist attack would cause stock prices to go up. Totally contrary results. But see, emotions are contrary. Emotions are not rational. Anything. You could say, how could it possibly cause prices to go up? Well, say that there were a terrorist attack. And say that the president, whoever happened to be in office at the time, responded very effectively. And say the terrorist attack didn't really end up doing that much damage. And then everyone looked at it and said, hey, I feel safer than I did before. We could be in a situation where we were about to go into a recession and suddenly national confidence increased and we avoided the recession. In other words, a terrorist attack that has survived could cause us to become more optimistic rather than more pessimistic. That can happen. Now, if it happens, of course, what someone like Melchale will say is, oh, what's happening is we're processing the greater, you know, the optimism is going to cause more consumer spending and the economy to recover, and that's going to make businesses, you know, earnings go up and blah, blah, blah. But it's not necessarily so. We could respond to this terrorist attack in a positive way. Stock prices go up, but then it was all a fantasy. And the reality is we just felt good because we survived the attack. And the economy goes into a recession a month later, and prices go down again. So in other words, none of this was really based on reason. It was just based on a temporary emotional flight of fancy. That's emotion, not reason. So what I'm saying in contrast to Melchale is that he is saying that short-term stock prices are... he is saying the reason you cannot predict stock prices is that the market predicts them better than you can. The market is smarter than the individual. And so it's pointless to try to predict prices. The market will get it right, you will get it wrong. I am saying The reason you can't predict short-term stock price changes is that the market it's just all emotion. It's just a big ball of emotion in the short term, and that's beyond human reason. You can't predict it. And that becomes significant, the distinction between what Melchal is saying and what I am saying. We say the same thing in the short term, that short-term timing does not work, that short-term predictions do not work. But it becomes significant in the long term, because when you get 5 years out or 10 years out, I'm saying then prices become somewhat predictable, because investing becomes more rational over time, the market becomes more efficient over time. Whereas Melchal just sticks to the same story. He just says, starting on the first day, the market is perfectly efficient, and it's always perfectly efficient, and so prices are, you can never beat the market. Whereas under the rational model, you know, the claim is that you can't beat the market in the short term. You can't figure out the market in the short term. But 10 years out, yes, you can. Yes, you can. Any investor who avoids the emotion that is reflected in the market price has an edge on the market. And it's not hard to know how emotional the market is. And to avoid it, all you have to do is look at the PE10 level. The PE10 level tells you how emotional the market is. So if the market assigns itself a price double fair value, you know to pull back on stocks, because you know that that price is a phony emotional price. And you don't want to be going down that path. All right. I don't want to go into a long discussion of efficient market theory versus the rational model. But it's important for purposes of this discussion, because it shows the difference in how the two models look at the question of investing news. Bogle and the other passive investors, they all say tune out the noise. Rob Bennett says tune out the noise. But I don't think passive investing succeeds in helping investors to tune out the noise. When I go to discussion boards where passive investors are participating, what I see is an obsession with short-term developments. And the reason why there's an obsession is Melchal and Bogle are not saying that news developments don't matter. They're saying you can't beat the market. They're saying you shouldn't try to outsmart the market, and that's why you should tune out the quote-unquote noise. But they're not saying that these developments are not significant. What they are really saying is that they are significant. They're saying the market is pricing them in. Effectively, they're saying the market is pricing in all these developments with you know, something close to 100% precision. And the market price is changing based on economic changes. How can an investor who believes that not care about the economic developments that happen on a day-to-day basis? How can a passive investor not care about the news? I say it's impossible. If you believe that the news is significant, even if you believe you can't change it, and even if you believe you can't change your allocation based on it and profit from doing so, you're still going to care about those news developments. You're still going to be watching. You're still going to be tuned in, you know, to CNN or whatever it is that, you know, reports the stock changes. You're still going to care. But if you become a rational investor, if you follow the rational model, and you believe that these short-term changes are not based on economic developments, they're just based on will-o'-the-wisp fantasies, emotional junk that just comes along and gets blown away in the wind, then you genuinely get to a point where you don't care. You don't care what they say in the news. Now, I care what they say about the news in the news in terms of being a citizen. In other words, we're in a recession today. You know, that affects me as a citizen. It affects, you know, what they're going to do in Congress, all this sort of thing. It affects whether people are going to have jobs, you know. So I care about it from that perspective. But as an investor, no. The only thing I care about as an investor is, what sort of value proposition do I get from stocks? Because that's the thing I control. I can change my stock allocation in response to changes in the value proposition of stocks. So that's all I look at. And if you notice, I talk about the value proposition of stocks in the introduction to every podcast. The value proposition of stocks is determined by the PE10 level. So all I need to know, all my investing news, is contained in the PE10 level. Now, that does not mean, this is the critical point of this podcast, that does not mean that I'm some automaton and all I look at is PE10. And a lot of my critics fall into the trap of thinking that that's what it means. They say, oh, Rob, it's, you know, PE10 is his god. All he thinks about is PE10. It's his, what do they use these derogatory terms like, it's my signal. It's my signal, you know, for whether to increase my stock allocation or not. Or they say, oh, Rob has a scheme. He has a scheme on how to beat the market. No. I look at PE10 to determine the value proposition of stocks. That's all. But because I do that, that one number, that, and I only look at PE10, I look at it to do the podcast, but if I weren't doing the podcast, I wouldn't even look at PE10. I'd probably look at it once every 6 months, once a year. I don't even bother to look at the PE10 level, except when I do a podcast, I sometimes look it up so I have a rough idea, I can give the correct number. When you don't have to worry about the news, which passive investors say they don't worry about, but in reality they spend a lot of time talking about it. When you don't worry about the news, that allows other investing ideas to flood into your brain. All this trivial junk fills up your head with nonsense. This is what my friend was telling me when he was talking about newspapers. He said, there are only so many hours in a day. And when I gave up reading newspapers, this is my friend speaking, I was able to read, you know, novels or historical, you know, books on history or biographies for an hour a day that I didn't have available to me before. And it made me smarter. That's true. You know, nature abhors a vacuum. Open up an hour of your day and you're not just going to stop wasting your time with trivialities. You're going to fill your time up with something of value. Well, the same thing happens to you as an investor. Find an investing model that helps you to genuinely tune out the noise. Not just to pretend to do it like the passive investors do, but to actually do it in reality. And I have found that rational investing does this. And you will spend, your mental energies will be redirected, rechanneled, and you will start thinking about questions that matter. Questions of strategy, questions of what your allocation should be. My email. In the last podcast, the last two podcasts, I talked about emails from Michael Kitsis dealing with William Bengen, whether Bengen has become a short-term market timer. And Kitsis, Michael, he said some things in his last email, and I was very excited by that email. And, you know, he said he's running into a lot of financial planners who are losing confidence in the passive investing approach. And I said, that's wonderful. That's very, very, very encouraging. But Michael had some, you know, I came on strong to Michael in the last email, perhaps too strong, but these are judgment calls. But I believe Michael my view of Michael is that he's half in the old school, he's half in the new school. And I see it as my job, you know, to reach out my hand to him and sort of pull him out of the old school. He's struggling. He's trying to get out of the old, this is all my estimation. My view is that he's struggling to get out of the old school, but he's He's scared, is what I think. It's a scary thing to leave the comfort of the old school and become a true new school advocate. New school safe withdrawal rate research, new school new investing model. And so I'm trying to pull him out, and I have to make judgment calls as to how strong to come on. If I come on too strong, you scare him away. If you come on too easy, it never happens. So I came on strong in that last email because I saw some encouraging signs. But the thing that, one of the things that I don't want to use the word frustrate, but one of the things I noticed in the email was some of the things he said were just great. They were just off the charts great. He had a paragraph where he was talking about how he thinks through what he should advise his clients in terms of changing their stock allocation. And that stuff was gold. That's what I want. That's what I believe. All of these boards that are now discussing this passive investing idiocy, they should all be engaged in discussions of not whether you should change your stock allocation when prices change or not. That's obvious. In my mind, it's obvious. But the question they should be looking at is how much should you change your stock allocation? That's a real question. That's a meaty question. We could have 100 people come in, smart people, and out of those 100 people, we could have 50 different answers to that question. I like to think they wouldn't differ that much. They should be in the same general neighborhood. Maybe not. Maybe some of them would be sort of outlier ideas, but we could have many, many different ideas. And that would enrich our understanding of how stock investing works. And but Michael, that was the great part of the email. And then there was this other part where he was fussing and fretting about whether to use the word timing to describe what he was telling his clients to do. He was telling his clients stocks were overvalued a year ago and they should lower their allocations. But he didn't want to use the word timing. So he was saying, oh, it's not timing. It's prudent. It's prudent. I don't know what. And, it is prudent, of course, but it is timing, too. And this is Rob Bennett speaking, but the reason he's afraid to call it timing is because the passive investing thought police, have filled us up with this idea that there's something wrong with timing. Timing is bad. Don't admit you time the market. And so I feel like he's going through convoluted word games to pretend. All he's trying to do is help his clients. He's giving good advice. Michael was one of the smart ones. He got his clients to lower their allocations before the price crash, He has nothing to apologize for. It's the passive investing enthusiasts that should be apologizing. They're the ones that should be, being nervous about how they speak. But they're not nervous. They're passing out the same old junk they've been pushing for 30 years. Never change your allocation stocks for the long run. Stay the course. Blah, 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 blee, blee, blee. Same old stuff. And Michael's on tenterhooks, because he timed the market. And what I said, I don't remember if I said this in the email or not. I don't think I included it, but it was a line I was thinking of. I was going to say, Michael, say it loud. I'm a timer and I'm proud. I'm a market timer and I'm proud. There's nothing to be ashamed of. That's the job, to help your clients. It's impossible to be successful as a long-term investor if you don't time the market. There are, of course, some forms of timing that work and some forms that don't. The job is to tell people about the ones that work. And of course, part of the job at an earlier stage is to explore what works, to learn what works. And we can't learn unless we discuss it. And we can't discuss it until we start talking honestly and straight about the flaws of the passive model. This is my, you knew I was going to say that somewhere in this podcast because I say it in every darn one. We've got to get over this nonsense. We've got to start talking about the flaws of the passive model. because this model dominates discussion. It dominates thought today. And it dominates thought with stuff that has been proven wrong, stuff that has been discredited, stuff that has failed the real world test. So we need to move on. And my point here is that when you develop a model and learn about a model of stock investing that makes sense, you become able to actually tune out the news. Investing news makes us dumb. We want to tune it out, just like Bogle has been telling us for 3 decades. But passive investing doesn't do it. We see, when we look at how passive investors act in the real world, we see that they're obsessed with all the news developments. The reason why is that at the root of their model, there's a belief that the economic news really does matter. Maybe they say you can't beat it. They say you can't beat the market. So there's no use you can make of learning about the news. But still you're curious. You know, say you were say you're at a company and you're worried about there are going to be layoffs, and you're worried about, you know, whether you're going to lose your job or not. And say somebody says to you, well, you know, there's really nothing you can do about it. Either you're on the list that's going to get laid off. They're going to base it on work you've been doing for 10 years, and there's nothing you can do today to change it. Either you're going to be laid off or you're not. You're going to be fired or not. Well, they can tell you that. That's like Bogle saying, tune out the noise. They can tell you that, but every day you come into work and there's, you know, something in the rumor mill about who's on the list and who's not, you can bet you're going to be paying attention. You can't affect the result. You know, just like a passive investor believes he can't beat the market, but you sure want to know. You sure want to know what happened. It's the same way with investing news. Passive investors think they can't outsmart the market, but they still want to know what the market did. And they still want to know about the economic developments because they think the economic developments are significant. But the rational investor, no. The rational investor believes at a fundamental level that the market price is just emotion in the short term. So the economic developments really don't matter. Economic developments, of course, will cause the price to go up or down, but there's no way of knowing which way it's going to go because the changes are emotional, and the economic factors are going to cancel each other out over time. The rational investor starts with a presumption that the market is likely to perform in the long term somewhat as it always has in the past. So there's going to be good economic times and there's going to be bad economic times. But in the long term, the U.S. market is probably going to provide a real return of something around 6.5% real. That's a number that's applied for a long time. So he's not worried. He's not worried about what Greenspan. He's not worried about what the Fed. Greenspan's gone. I have to stop using Greenspan as my example. He's not going to worry about what the Fed's going to do. He's not going to worry about inflation. He's not going to worry about recession. As a citizen, he worries, but not as an investor. Because there's going to be a recession, and then there's going to be a recovery from the recession. And it's all going to be reflected in stock prices. And as long as he watches his allocation and keeps his risk level roughly constant, he's going to get that 6.5% over the long term as his average annual real return. So all these economic developments don't matter to the rational investor. To the rational investor, they truly are noise. Unlike the passive investor who calls them noise but cares about them and follows them and directs his mental energy. Well, once you free up that mental energy, once you stop paying attention to the news makes you dumb. Well, once you stop paying attention to the news, your mental energies are freed up to discuss or to think through the questions that really matter. Questions like how much, not should I change my allocation or not when there are dramatic changes in price, but how much should I change my allocation? Now you're talking about the real stuff. This is the difference. This is why the difference between passive investing and rational investing is the difference between night and day. There's an example. This was the example that got me thinking about this morning. I was over at Goon Central Board, and they were, you know, they ask me these questions, and they're taunting. They're not interested in learning, but I want to hear the questions because I want to hear if they come up with something good. And something they constantly come back to is they say they want to know, you know, exactly, you know, what you're supposed to do at each P10 level. You know, I'm supposed to give them some sort of precise, you know, at a P10 level of 18, you would lower your stock allocation by 6%. And, you know, at 19, you would lower it by another 2%. They want like these exact numbers. And that's, of course, crazy because the actual changes depend on the investor's financial circumstances and its risk tolerance and its life goals. There are no precise rules to rational investing. That's, you know, there are passive investors who try to come up with optimal, allocations and all this sort of nonsense. But that's not something a rational investor would even dream of doing. But, you know, what they're trying to do is they want to do this thing called backtesting. What they want to do is come up with all these rules and then, you know, stick the thing into a calculator. This is so like a passive investor. And then backtest. See how it would have worked in history. Now, you can backtest valuation-informed indexing, and valuation-informed indexing trounces passive investing when you backtest it properly using some reasonable assumptions. You know, I'm glad to see that happens. It certainly is confirmation of what common sense tells us and the historical data tells us. But backtesting does not prove that the allocation shifts that work in the numbers are the ones that investors in the real world should be using. You know, all that you're getting with a backtest is you're getting one run through that we've had historically, and one return sequence. That doesn't tell you the future return sequence is not going to be precisely the same. The assumption that we go with is that stocks will perform in the future somewhat as they always have in the past. We don't presume that they will perform in precisely the same return sequence. You know, that's crazy talk. And this is the benefit of the Scenario Surfer, the calculator at my website, that with the Scenario Surfer, you don't go through one sequence of returns, one of the possibilities. You can go, running the Surfer one time, you do go through one sequence. But anyone who runs it only one time is not doing it right. What you want to do is you want to run it a dozen times with the same inputs. So with a dozen run-throughs, you get a sense of what the probabilities are. And of course, if you do it 100 times, that's better than a dozen times. The more times you run it, the better. You get more of a sense of what the probabilities are. Now, you will find, you know, on a very general level, I can tell you, if you lower your stock allocation when we get to insanely dangerous levels, that's almost always going to work to your benefit. That's always going to be to your benefit. So you can draw these sort of general inferences. But if you're asking, you know, should I always lower my stock allocation when the PE10 level gets to 20? Or is there an argument for waiting till when the PE10 level gets to 22? That's something you would have to test. And even testing it with prior sequences is not going to give you a final answer, because we don't know what sequence is going to turn up starting today. So you can say, you might be able to say, well, generally 20 is the red alert danger zone. That, you know, you want to make at least some kind of shift to 20. You could say that, but that's as far as you can go. You can't say, oh, you should always go to 30% when we get to a PE10 level of 20. You know, it just doesn't work that way. That level of precision is comical and stupid. It's a blunt tool. It's a blunt way of taking the realities into account, and it takes a smart strategy and turns it into a stupid implementation. So my point, though, here is that this backtesting idea, it's an idea that just fascinates the passive investing mindset. And again, I think the problem is that there's something in passive investing, I think it's the irrationality at its core, that just causes a lack of security, causes an insecurity. And then people who follow it are always trying to make themselves secure. They have all these emotional needs, and so they're always looking to numbers, they want to back test, because that sounds scientific. It's got this, quasi-scientific tone to it. And they'll say it's not. They'll say, we don't mean it to be scientific, but they sort of do. And they're, that's the flaw in the passive investing model. In other words, the flaw is very deep. The flaw is not just that there's not an adjustment for valuations. The flaw is that when you fail to make that adjustment, it has emotional ramifications. And those emotional ramifications cause you to divert all kinds of human energies into all kinds of non-productive activity. And I just see this all the time. Of course, it's the whole story of the great safe withdrawal rate debate. I think of the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of man and woman hours that have been devoted not to learning how to invest effectively, but how to avoid learning how to invest effectively. All the hours devoted to word games, and smear campaigns, and all this other gibberish, when we could be spending our time learning how to invest. And again, I think what's going on there is that the passive investing mindset focuses in on the trivial, because it's actually afraid of looking at the realities. So this is where I see the real damage from the passive investing model coming in, that it's not some small problem. It's a big problem. It's an all-encompassing problem. It's a mindset that tells the investor to avoid the realities, because once you decide to go passive, you don't want to know the investing realities, because the investing realities say not to go passive. And so all reality becomes frightening to you. And to fill up that void, nature abhors a vacuum. The passive investor seeks out trivialities. He seeks out investing news. He wants to know, where's the Dow going? Where's the S&P going? What's the Fed doing? And then he looks for things like backtesting and he looks for all these numbers exercises, and it's gibberish piled on gibberish piled on gibberish. Not because these people are stupid. These people are highly intelligent. And it's sad because they're using their intelligence not to learn how to invest. They are using their intelligence to avoid learning how to invest. I really think that's true. And we only have so much time in our life. We all are pressed for time. And it's so sad to see people spending, what time they have and what mental energy they have on these fruitless endeavors. But, my job is to figure out why they do it. I see it play out before my eyes, and my mind says why. And I think this is a big part of the answer. It's the reason why, even though Bogle says tune out the noise, his admonition to tune out the noise has never, it's fallen on barren ground. Because the passive investor needs the noise. You know how a neurotic, a person who is anxious about just everything, anxiety means you're afraid, but you don't really know what you're afraid of. It's sort of a buried fear. Passive investors are anxious investors. And, an anxious person will, they'll turn on the television when they come into the house. And they'll leave it on until they go to bed at night. They always want that background noise. Not because they're watching a program. You know, you're watching a program, obviously you're going to turn the television on. You might even ask everybody else in the house to be quiet so they can hear it. You know, you're watching a movie and you don't want to lose the plot. But I don't think it's healthy, you know, to have that noise on in the background every minute of the day. But that's a way, I think that's a way of coping with anxiety. It's a way of getting your mind unfocused. That's what I see passive investors doing when they engage in all these crazy mental exercises, these statistical tests they run, and of course they fail to take valuations into account in these tests. So all the numbers are wrong, but they generate them like crazy. There's this guy Trevor at the Vanguard Diehards Board. He's a nice guy. And he would generate, you know, he doesn't get paid for this, but he would generate these statistical, you know, studies, whatever, you know, one-offs. They weren't studies. They were just analyses of questions that would come up. And the guy obviously put a lot of work into it. He's a nice guy. He's trying to help. But if you mention to him that, hey, you know, if you don't count valuations, the numbers aren't going to be right. You know, he doesn't want to hear that. He'd rather spend all this time just generating these numbers, you know, numbers piled on numbers piled on numbers, but they don't go anywhere. Or they'll generate these back testing, and you know, they'll come to me and they'll say, "Oh, Rob, you know, what are your signals? What's your scheme say?" I don't have a scheme. I don't have any signals. I have common sense. I know that valuations affect long-term returns, so I know I have to change my allocation when prices change dramatically. That's all I need to know. I don't need a scheme. I don't need any signals. And I don't need to hear the investing news. I don't need to hear the investing news. I don't pay attention to it. I look at articles. I'm interested in theory. I'm interested in discussions of strategy. I'm certainly interested in anything that deals with the demise of passive investing and the rise of rational investing. I certainly look at questions on valuations. I look at questions on investor psychology because I think these areas have been greatly underanalyzed in the past. So I want to learn as much as I can about those areas, but I couldn't even tell you what the Dow does on a day-to-day basis or even a year-to-year basis unless I have to look it up. Bogle's advice on that question has hit home with Rob Bennett. And I don't just talk the talk on that when I walk the walk. And I think it's because I don't believe anymore that the economic developments, the short-term economic developments, really have any lasting significance. I really don't think it matters. My belief is that those things are going to average out over the long term. And stocks are going to generate something in the neighborhood of 6.5% real in the long term. And that to get that 6.5%, I've got to adjust my stock allocation in response to price changes to keep my risk level roughly constant. So that's what I do. It's as simple can be. But it, you know, I believe it works. And it keeps me from wasting time and energy following the investing news. And that makes me smart, because investing news makes me dumb. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.